This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, two Guantanamo Bay inmates who allege that they were tortured for years are heading for the ICC, the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
We speak with their attorney, Catherine Gallagher, and what she thinks she can accomplish in Holland.
We'll hear excerpts from talks at the November 21st book launch for In Defense of Julian Assange.
We're going to hear Barry Pollack, Julian Assange, the lawyer in the United States, Amy Goodman, and Margaret Ratner, Kunstler, who edited the book that was launched on November 21st, In Defense of Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The International Criminal Court was established in 1998 and began sitting in 2002. To date, there are 123 countries who have ratified the Rome Statute that created the ICC and participate in it. The role of the ICC is to bring to justice the world's worst crimes known to humankind: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The United States of America is not one of the 123 countries who participate in this international court, but it still can be investigated and tried if the crimes it commits were committed in one of the 123 countries. We speak with senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Catherine Gallagher. She will be appearing before the ICC in The Hague in Holland on December 4th. Attorney Gallagher will be representing two men currently being held and indefinitely detained in the United States offshore prison camp in Guantanamo, Cuba. These men allege that they were tortured by the CIA in Afghanistan, one of the 123 countries.
Katie Gallagher, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Who are your clients, and can you please tell us why they're being held in Guantanamo? Let's start with Sharkawi Al-Haj.
So Sharkawi Al-Haj is a Yemeni citizen who was picked up back in 2002 in Pakistan. He was picked up and handed over to the United States. Now, your question was, why is he in Guantanamo? I would start that answer with the fact that there is no good reason for him to be in Guantanamo after 17 years of detention by the U.S. This is a man who has never been charged with a crime. So he is being held in Guantanamo, essentially in a legal limbo for all these years. But he had been picked up in Pakistan and transferred by the United States to Jordan, where he was first held in proxy detention. So he was asked questions in Jordan, which is actually a state party to the International Criminal Court, for a number of months before then being transferred on to Afghanistan, where he was again detained and subjected to acts of torture. And Afghanistan is a member state of the International Criminal Court. And then he was transferred on to Guantanamo. Sharkawi Al-Haj, as I know, is not doing particularly well right now. This state of legal limbo is extremely challenging.
When you talk about his health and mental status.
His physical health and his mental status. And I think it's important for listeners to remember that the crime of torture, the act of torture, is one that doesn't just entail physical acts, but it's also the infliction of severe mental harm. And unfortunately, I learned, because I don't have direct contact with Sharkawi, I learned when documents were made public that my colleague is litigating in U.S. courts that he tried to commit suicide this past summer. So this state of prolonged detention without any end in sight is itself a form of torture.
Please tell us about your client, Gulid Dhuran. He is, I understand it, a victim of the CIA's so-called RDI program. What is that?
Sure. So Ghaleed Duran is a Somali citizen. He was transferring for medical care in early 2003 through Djibouti. And while transferring through, he was detained by Djiboutian forces and turned over to the CIA. He has been termed by the United States a so-called high-value detainee. So Ghaleed, after being transferred on the territory of Djibouti to the CIA, and Djibouti is also a member state of the International Criminal Court, I frankly don't know where Ghaleed went next. I do not have access to classified information. I have colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights who are litigating in U.S. courts, so my knowledge is really pulled from the public record. But that public record is quite damning. That public record includes documents from the International Committee of the Red Cross after it finally received access years after detention of these so-called high-value detainees, of which Ghaleed is one. And that ICRC report documents the physical and mental torture that he was subjected to, as well as other crimes. And there's a note in that report that indicates that he was at some point detained on the territory of Afghanistan. So that is the link between him and the International Criminal Court. Now, this RDI program that you asked about, that stands for Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation. And so the way Ghaleed went from Djibouti somewhere, eventually Afghanistan, and now has been languishing also in Guantanamo, that is it through a series of flights. These rendition flights that people may recall hearing about. Meher Arar is one of the most well-known Canadian citizen victims of rendition, where the U.S. essentially was just sending people to different pockets of the world and detaining them and interrogating them there, sometimes directly and sometimes through proxies, like I indicated with Jordan. So what is called by some a rendition, detention, and interrogation program, I frankly call the U.S. torture program.
We're speaking with attorney Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights. She's about to go to The Hague to appear before the International Criminal Court. Katie, what is it alleged by the U.S. that your two clients did?
Well, again, neither individual has been charged with a crime, so that's a very difficult question to answer. The U.S., in the aftermath of September 11th, as people may be aware, sent over nearly 800 individuals to Guantanamo, of whom only 40 are left. Now, those 40 should not be there, let's be clear. But I think that the huge number of individuals who were released speak to the fact that what the U.S. was essentially doing was picking up people who they suspected of any kind of link to terrorism. And that was a very, very low bar and a very vague standard. So it could be that there were individuals who were in a neighborhood where they heard that there was someone and they just did roundups. A very large number of individuals who were detained by the U.S. had actually been sold to the U.S., picked up and sold for a bounty. So the idea that there are credible criminal allegations against these two men or so many others who've been through the U.S. torture program, whether in black sites in Eastern Europe, in proxy detention sites in countries like Jordan or other North African countries, just in places around the world and certainly in Guantanamo, the fact that there are criminals, I think, is a premise that we shouldn't start with.
What kind of defense in the course of your litigation, what kind of defense does the USA put up to your protests about these men being detained for so long as they have been?
Well, in the context of U.S. litigation, which is done by my colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights, there have been a range of defenses. First of all, the U.S. has argued that no law applies. There were years and years of fighting just to be able to get into U.S. courts to access the men in Guantanamo and then to have some level of legal protections apply to them. The U.S. has made arguments in part because of the status of the individuals as suspected terrorists or suspected members of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban that they should not have legal protections. But frankly, the defense of the U.S. has been a stall tactic over years and years and years. It has not been to try these cases on the merits. And because of the fact that so many of the individuals who the U.S. detained were subjected to acts of torture with coerced, in some cases, with the coerced confessions, if there's any evidence, that there really is no way to proceed to trial for the vast majority of individuals.
So what do you hope to accomplish when you go to The Hague?
So the piece of work that I have been doing for the last maybe 14 years, which was really, as listeners of this program will know his name well, was started by Michael Ratner and Peter Weiss. This is the accountability side of the work. So I have a set of colleagues who are working to release the men, and then what I have been working to do is hold high-level U.S. officials responsible for this program accountable. And that could be through civil remedies. We've tried that in the U.S. courts and have been unsuccessful. But I have been also trying in foreign national courts under universal jurisdiction. And that work has now brought us to kind of the highest level of criminal court in the world, and that's the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And so what we are saying, that this court of last resort, a place that is designed to take cases when no national system is either willing or able, is the appropriate place to adjudicate the crimes committed by U.S. citizens on the territory of ICC member states. So I mentioned the fact that Afghanistan is a member of the ICC, Djibouti is a member of the ICC, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, where CIA black sites were, they are members of the ICC. The situation at the case, which we call a situation at the ICC, is focused on crimes that were committed on the territory of Afghanistan or that have a close link to the armed conflict there. So because the individuals that I represent, Sharkawi and Ghalid, at some point were on the territory and detained on the territory and subjected to crimes on the territory of Afghanistan, they should fall within the jurisdiction of the ICC. So, long answer, but the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, had asked the ICC judges to allow her to open an investigation into Afghanistan, an investigation that included crimes committed by the Taliban, crimes committed by Afghan national forces, and crimes committed by U.S. actors. Ghalid and Sharkawi put in their representations, their stories of what happened to them, and they urged the court to open this investigation. The Trump administration, led by Donald Trump himself, at a speech at the UN, John Bolton, while he was still in office, and Mike Pompeo all went on an aggressive campaign against the ICC. They threatened sanctions, they threatened to prosecute ICC staff members, and they ultimately also canceled the visa of Prosecutor Bensouda to the United States. And so 2 weeks after that action was taken, unfortunately, the ICC pretrial chamber came out with a decision saying no to authorizing the investigation. And so what I'll be doing in The Hague December 4th through 6th is arguing on behalf of Sharkawi, on behalf of Ghalid, and frankly trying to also make a broader argument for other victims that the ICC should open this investigation, that it clearly has jurisdiction over these crimes, and that there is nowhere else in the world where these crimes can be and will be adjudicated.
Let me clarify, Katie. A favorable ruling would mean that an investigation would be opened.
Yes.
It wouldn't be a final determination.
No. So what would happen next is that the prosecutor then, who has been sort of passively receiving information, would be able to open her full toolbox. She would be able to send her investigators to Afghanistan and other locations. She would be able to make formal requests to those countries that are member states to send on things like maybe cables that they had with the United States, interrogation information that they have, flight data. So then she would be able to build that case. And one of the complaints by the U.S. has been, look, you know, we're not going to cooperate with this. How can you build a case against us? Well, there's plenty of information out in the public domain, and certainly in the intelligence services of all of these member states, because the U.S. implicated so many countries as complicit, as co-conspirators in this program.
I'm curious, when the ICC conducts an investigation and seeks information from other countries, not counting the U.S., how cooperative have other states been?
The other states have generally been cooperative. Europe speaks highly of the ICC. They do have complaints about some of the more administrative side of operations, but when it comes to the mandate, European countries in particular have said that we want a strong ICC and we believe in the ICC. And so as member states, they are obligated to cooperate. Currently, there's a what's called a preliminary examination. This is stage one, involving the UK with acts of torture in Iraq. Now, Iraq is not a state party, but because the UK is, it can be investigated. And over the last number of years, there has been a lot of back and forth between the UK and the ICC, with the UK trying to make the argument, you don't need to investigate us because we're investigating ourselves. So they have been engaging in that process. Now, whether that process will lead to an investigation, as I think it should, because they haven't taken enough action, remains to be seen. But there is at least an engagement.
In a very general question, we all know that torture is illegal, unlawful under domestic, international, and even military law. Why do you think that the practice of torture by U.S. officials has not been brought to justice? And what was Obama's position on this?
Yeah, why it was not brought to justice is a question I wish I had a good answer for. You know, I think that the U.S. torture program that we saw exercised in the post-9/11 era unfortunately has echoes in other U.S. policies as well, whether it's domestic policies or whether it's other aspects of foreign policy. Maybe there was a fear of opening a Pandora's box to look at U.S. criminal conduct. You know, there are also so many individuals who approved and participated in that program. But we're saying that it should be the architects. So the senior civilian government leadership, the senior military, the senior CIA, and the private contractors. That's who we're suggesting and feel strongly should be investigated. So not everyone who participated wouldn't, of course, come before the ICC. But I think to send that clear message that you can't get away with these crimes is critical. Right now, we have someone who's heading our CIA, Gina Haspel, who had run a black site during the Bush administration. You asked what President Obama's position had been. His position was, let's look forward, not back. And I think having Gina Haspel run the CIA, someone who ran a black site, is Exhibit A of why Obama's position was so wrong. Because if you don't have accountability, if you don't have a deterrent factor, you're going to have reoccurrence. And with Donald Trump now pardoning war criminals and reports coming out that he hired Gina Haspel, not despite her torture credentials, but because of them, it's quite frightening.
Yeah, she was known as Bloody Gina. Katie, why is it that the United States is not part of the ICC?
Yeah, the U.S. is not and has not ever been a full member of the ICC. During the Clinton administration is when the statute was negotiated. And the concerns that the U.S. expressed most strongly was the fact that there was an independent prosecutor. So here what we have is the Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda deciding to open an investigation that would include U.S. actors. What the U.S. had wanted way back 20 years ago was Security Council oversight of the prosecutor. They lost that fight. So I think there was a concern about an independent prosecutor doing precisely what we see now. That's one argument. Now, if you're a part of the international community who purports to abide by the rule of law, you should not be worried about an independent prosecutor because he won't come before the court. There are some other smaller procedural arguments that the U.S. makes, like, oh, we don't have a jury trial. Well, the U.S. didn't have a jury in Nuremberg and certainly supported the Yugoslav and Rwandan war crimes tribunals where you did not have juries. You had professional judges who adjudicate these cases. So a lot of their arguments fall short, but essentially it's an unwillingness to turn over jurisdiction to an international body, regardless of how qualified the judges are at that body. I would note that the U.S. ambassador during those Rome negotiations is an individual named David Sheffer. David Sheffer is now a professor at Northwestern. And David Sheffer has put in a request as amicus to appear at the hearing in The Hague December 4th through 6th on the question of whether or not the investigation should be opened. And he is putting forward the position that the investigation should be opened. He is explaining what the U.S. concerns were in the statute, again, more around the idea of an independent prosecutor. But now that the statute is there, he will say that the U.S. was not concerned about this interest of justice argument in the way the pretrial chamber set forth. So that is at least what he has put forward in his amicus request. We'll see what his argument is. It will be in the hearing, but I think that that's significant. And I would just add that a second former U.S. ambassador at large, an individual named Stephen Rapp, who was the war crimes ambassador during Obama's years and was also a chief prosecutor for the special court for Sierra Leone, he has also put in an amicus brief, along with other former prosecutors, including Ben Ferenc, 99 years old now, who had been at Nuremberg. Yeah. And they are urging this investigation to be opened. So the U.S. position of the government may be one thing, but the position of Americans is much, much more diverse.
I wanted to dovetail with that, Katie, in terms of the amicus or friend of the court briefs. Did you get good support in terms of that? Those sound fabulously important. And how does the ICC look on amicus briefs in terms of the weight they carry?
Well, in this case, it was interesting. The court actually put out a call for amicus briefs. There are some novel legal questions here about victims' rights, about the jurisdiction of the court, certainly about what interests of justice means. And so they invited academics, NGOs to put in amicus briefs. They also invited states to put in observations. And I believe the number of requests they got to put in an amicus brief, which they're calling, again, more observations, that there were 16 requests, of which 14 are supportive of opening the investigation. And the appeals chamber said that you can either put in a written brief or you can appear in person. So 8 or 9 briefs went in on November 15th, and then we'll have 6 amici in the courtroom, including a representative of former UN Special Rapporteurs for Torture, who themselves have looked extensively at the impact of the U.S. torture program on international human rights writ large and on the idea of having a remedy for torture. One of the amicus in this case is an individual named Jay Sekulow, who is the quote-unquote personal attorney of Donald Trump. He has a European-based NGO, so he will also be in court. And just based on interviews that we've seen him give, we can anticipate that he will not be arguing for the opening of the investigation.
Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. We're running out of pavement in the road here, but we don't want to stop yet. I had a couple more questions, and I think Heidi does also. If you win, how do you enforce it?
If the appeals chamber were to rule in our favor, What we hope will happen is that they will authorize this investigation straight away and that the prosecutor will move expeditiously to actually build her individual cases against named individuals. That is still a bit of a process ahead of us, but we hope that we will be seeing the equivalent of indictments in the near future. I think the question you raised, though, is a good one. It is going to be challenging to enforce arrest warrants if they are ever issued, whether it's for the Taliban or for U.S. forces. But, again, these 122 member states of the ICC all have obligations to arrest and transfer to the court individuals. So that may mean if there were to be U.S. citizens who had charges against them or arrest warrants against them, that they wouldn't be able to travel in the same way that they do now because, let's say, they went to Europe. Europe should turn them over to the ICC.
Katie, it's been so many years. Let's remind our listeners, when and why was Guantanamo actually set up?
Guantanamo, the first prisoners arrived in January 2002, and it was set up essentially to be a legal black hole. It's plain and simple. As the Bush administration was starting to do detentions in Afghanistan or Pakistan, it wanted to send these quote-unquote suspected terrorists, many of whom had zero, and you know, none of, so few of whom there could have ever been a credible case built against them, but they wanted to send them to a place where they were beyond the reach of the law, and they effectively disappeared them. Until 2004, when the Supreme Court ruled that lawyers could have access to the individuals at Guantanamo, they were truly cut off and disappeared, cut off from the rest of the world and disappeared.
You're an international lawyer. What did you think yesterday when we heard the news that Trump had fired the Secretary of the Navy around the circumstances with three men, one of whom had been convicted of a war crime, and Trump let these three people go? What was your reaction to that?
I mean, it's so disturbing. We have so much impunity here, and these are cases where there was some small measure of accountability, and the message that was sent with those pardons and Donald Trump's tweet, "Get back to business," having previously tweeted that we train people to be killing machines. I think that is so terrifying, frankly, that we have a commander-in-chief who is granting impunity for war crimes and essentially saying that this is the work that should be done by the military. I think this is precisely why we need to be at the ICC, why there needs to be oversight of the U.S. I worry what this means for the concept of responsible command within the military. Over the many years that I've been working in the international criminal law sphere, and especially back here in the U.S., some of our strongest allies have been from the military because they appreciate the importance of compliance with the Hague regulations and the Geneva Conventions for themselves and how critical those rules are to ensure that the men and women that are trained, that wear the U.S. uniform, comply with basic standards of humanity. And war is not a pleasant thing. No one has any illusion about that. And I think especially in the trauma of war, it is so critical to know precisely what you can and can't do and to have clear boundaries set forth. So the message that Donald Trump sent was very dangerous. I would also just add that I got a message from a colleague in Afghanistan about the pardons, and he said that he's getting calls from families wanting to know if maybe the victims were their family members. So I think it's important to also realize the impact that these pardons have on Afghanistan or in Iraq, what message this is sending where we have done so much harm to so many civilians. And frankly, I looked for their names, you know, to see could I find information about who the victims were beyond those who were suspected terrorists. And that's not reported. And there are so many victims around the world of crimes by the, unfortunately, by criminal actions by some members of the U.S. military, and those victims are forgotten. So
I just want to remind listeners that one of the three, Chief Officer Edward Gallagher, was accused of shooting civilians, killing a captive Islamic State fighter with a hunting knife in Iraq, and then threatening to kill SEALs who reported him. His court-martial actually ended in acquittal on those charges, but he was convicted of bringing discredit to the armed forces when he posed for photos with the teenage captive's body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that says it all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Katie, before we let you go, how can people follow your work and the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and particularly the situation in the still-standing Guantanamo offshore prison?
Sure. A couple of ways that people can follow. First of all, for the ICC hearing on December 4th through 6th, if you're hearing this before the hearing, the proceedings will be webcast live by the ICC. Well, I should say with the 30-minute delay, but they will be up on the website of the ICC, as will the transcripts. You can follow the Center for Constitutional Rights at ccrjustice.org and our Twitter account at the CCR, and we will be having information about not only the proceedings at The Hague at the ICC, but also why we are engaged in these proceedings, about the individuals, the men who are still at Guantanamo, and the struggle that they have for justice.
Attorney Catherine Gallagher, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. You're following in the footsteps of Michael Ratner, and it's a great pleasure for Heidi and I to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Whistleblowing, truth-telling journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange now sits in solitary confinement in London's infamous Belmarsh prison. The Trump administration has asked that he be extradited to Virginia for trial as a spy. He faces 175 years in prison. The just-published book, In Defense of Julian Assange, demonstrates convincingly that what is at stake in his upcoming trial is the future of free journalism here and abroad. The book is co-edited by Margaret Kunstler. We hear today a speech that she gave at the book launch on November 21st. We also hear a short talk by Assange's attorney, Barry Pollack, and a description of what Julian Assange did by Amy Goodman, which so enraged the United States.
A really important place, because this house is where Michael worked. And he worked downstairs in this house for Julian Assange. And every day he was on his cryptophone. I inherited the cryptophone. Getting away from my joy at this evening, I want to tell you that we're in a very, very difficult period. These are very, very dangerous times. We see what's happening to the world. The right wing is taking over, and we're not in any control, and everything is getting narrower and narrower. And it's also a time when we're being distracted from what is really happening and not paying attention to the important things. What is happening is that the powers that be are upping the ante. Charging a journalist with espionage is eating the First Amendment. It's outrageous. The First Amendment doesn't allow for an espionage charge. The entire indictment violates the First Amendment. And anybody who's a journalist who is sensitive to this knows that this is a total threat to news gathering, to giving out information, and to educating people about what's happening. It's a total threat. And on the other side of it, Julian is being housed in a prison as if he's a terrorist. So this is really upping the ante. We're getting rid of the First Amendment, and we're holding Julian as if he's a terrorist. He's a journalist. He should be out on bail. Why is he in 24-hour segregation, isolated in a maximum security prison? This is where we are. This is a terrible situation. Secrecy is power, and Julian's ability to inform people has really saved many people. And if you read in this book, Jen Robinson, who is one of Julian's lawyers and a human rights attorney, she describes how the work that Julian has done has saved her clients. And she's really thrilled because she gets to use the information that he puts out. If you read what Michael Ratner says at the end, he says, well, things have been going so badly that Julian is only the light, because he's had so many cases in which national security has been brought up as the reason why he can't go forward, that he looks at Julian as the possibility of going forward, and he doesn't see any possibility. So we have a lot of different views in this book, and it's a wonderful book, and I hope you all purchase it and share it and use it as a tool the way other people are. Thank you very much.
I'm Barry Pollack. I'm a lawyer, and I have the great privilege of representing Julian Assange in the criminal charges that have been brought against him in the United States. I was honored when I was invited to this event and asked to speak last, and I thought this was great because, you know, I could just plagiarize from what everybody else had already said. The bad news is everybody's already said anything, so there's not a lot left for me. I really want to thank Margie for this book and for everybody who contributed to it. It is so vitally important. James Goodall, who Nathan mentioned, is the former general counsel of the New York Times who fought the war over the Pentagon Papers, has said that the criminal case involving Julian Assange is not just the greatest First Amendment case of this century, it is the greatest First Amendment case of any century. So thanks, James, no pressure. It is the gravest threat to the First Amendment we have seen. Whether you are on the left or the right, I don't know how anybody can listen to what Amy just talked about and say that there was nothing newsworthy about the collateral murder video showing American military personnel gunning down Reuters staffers who were visibly carrying cameras when they were assassinated and injuring small children. The idea that there are people on the ground raising their hands and that military personnel are calling back and saying, are we allowed to shoot? What are the rules of engagement? And the answer came back, you can't surrender to a helicopter, smoke them. No one can argue that it was not in the public's interest to know what the American government was doing in the name of American citizens. This is not just about Julian Assange's right to publish. It is about our right to know what the government is doing in our name. And there is, in my mind, no more important cause than supporting Julian Assange, fighting his extradition to the United States, and if they are successful in bringing him here, defending him against these charges that are a threat literally to journalists all over the world. I mean, Julian Assange is an Australian citizen publishing in the UK, and that shows you the lengths the United States government will go to suppress information about what the United States government has done. So please buy the book. Please go to the Courage Foundation's website, defendwikileaks.org. Make a contribution, and more importantly, sign up, give us your contact information so we can be in touch about events like the event in February, and encourage your friends, your colleagues to do the same. This, to me, is not a political issue. This is not about the 2016 election. This is about the leaks in 2010 and 2011 by Chelsea Manning. That is what Julian Assange is being prosecuted for. He's being prosecuted for publishing that video that Amy talked about. The Obama administration reviewed this matter and decided not to charge Julian Assange because it would be utterly inconsistent with First Amendment values to criminally prosecute a publisher for publishing truthful information. The Obama administration also commuted the sentence of Chelsea Manning, the leaker, from 35 years to 7 years, essentially time served. There has been absolutely no new information that has come to light, but the current administration obviously has taken a position 180 degrees differently and has charged Assange with 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act and with the unauthorized access of a computer, which was Chelsea Manning accessing the computer that she had the right to access as military personnel and leaking that information to Assange. She is facing 180 years of prison in the United States for publishing truthful information. So I really want to thank everybody who's involved. I want to just say how privileged I was to know Michael Ratner and his efforts, not just on behalf of Assange, but so many causes. And I want to thank Margie and thank all of you for being here. It's really heartwarming to see this many people here. Now let's all recruit 10 people we know and really grow this so that we have a strong and united voice in the United States that it is not okay to prosecute someone for publishing truthful information. Thank you.
I'm Nathan Fuller, director of the Courage Foundation, and want to thank Colin and OR Books for putting this together, and thank you all for being here. Royalties from this book are going to go to the Courage Foundation, and so I figured I should tell you what that's all about. In 2014, we started Courage, in its international organization, in right now primarily US and UK, as a hub for whistleblowers, a support network of all kinds for whistleblowers and other journalistic sources. And so we help make Edward Snowden's documents searchable, the whole archive, text searchable. We've raised funds and awareness for Jeremy Hammond and Chelsea Manning and their legal teams, especially since the Moreno administration started tightening the screws on Assange in the embassy. We've been really focused on supporting Assange and WikiLeaks. And that means we raise funds for the legal defense team in the UK, and we write a daily live blog about political, legal developments, Assange's prison conditions, which, as you've heard, are horrendous. And in the US here, I help organize events. And to that end, we can announce that on February 12th at People's Forum in Midtown, we'll have a big Assange and press freedom event. So that's just 2 weeks before his extradition hearing in London. And James Goodale, who's the former New York Times general counsel who defended that paper's right to publish the Pentagon Papers, will be speaking there as well. So look out for that. We'll have more information and other speakers and everything going forward. So yeah, I just want to thank you all for coming here. Thanks for the book and event, and appreciate it. Take care.
Hi, everyone. It's really quite remarkable to be back here at 124 Washington. Thanks all for coming out. I think it was April of 2010 that video documents and thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, millions of documents were released by WikiLeaks. Among them was a video of what happened on July 17th, 2007. This was a moment that a group of Iraqis were walking in the area of New Baghdad, in Baghdad, Iraq. And they were walking with to show two Reuters journalists, up-and-coming videographer, revered in the Reuters community, 22-year-old Namir Nur Eldin, and his driver, Saeed Shama, who was 40 years old and was the dad of four kids. Both of them were so well-respected at Reuters. Years later, I would be at a Reuters studio in Washington, D.C., and I would see the book of the Reuters dead, the reporters who had died around the world, that was right at the elevator when people came in so they wouldn't forget. So Saeed, Namir, and the community of New Baghdad were walking because the men in the community wanted to show these two journalists what had happened the day before. A bombing had taken place and killed a number of people. And as they walked, Saeed and Namir holding cameras, a U.S. helicopter, Apache helicopter, flew overhead. The reason we have this is because of WikiLeaks. And it wasn't the video of an Iraqi resident on the ground or a peace activist. It was the army video footage from the vantage point of the Apache helicopter. And it showed the men below. It showed the men holding the cameras as well. And you heard the voices, the laughter, the chatter, the cursing of the U.S. soldiers. And as they observed what was happening below, they talked about opening fire on this group of Iraqis. They had a question about it, though, and so they called back to the forward operating base, and they said, can we open fire? So this wasn't a rogue group. They got permission, and they opened fire, killing something like a dozen of the men, including, well, Namir Nour-Eldin died almost immediately. Saeed Shammah was injured. He was crawling away. You can see in the video as the men, the soldiers, are laughing and cursing. And then a van pulled up. A dad was taking his two kids to school. But he saw the carnage and he wanted to help the wounded. And so he was pulling up to stop. Again, the soldiers asked for permission to open fire on the vehicle that was pulling up. They got the permission, they opened fire, and in the process, they finished off Saeed Shammah. That was the two Reuters employees, the journalist and his driver. But to be a fixer in Iraq, you were essentially a reporter, Saeed, because you would have these foreign journalists coming in and they would show them the whole area and he would introduce them to people to interview. So Saeed and Namir were killed. Reuters immediately responded to the head of Reuters International, demanding to know what had taken place, demanding any record of what had taken place. And this went on for years. The U.S. government said there was no record. In the end, that video was released, thanks to Chelsea Manning and WikiLeaks. I dare say these two Reuters staffers and the men in the community, the children, by the way, were critically wounded, might not have happened if we had also gotten the documents earlier of what happened 6 months before. That was in February of 2007. We also learned this from the leak of WikiLeaks documents. Two Iraqis were walking. Same Apache helicopter unit is overhead. And when the men saw the Apache helicopter unit, they put up their hands as if to surrender. The soldiers again called back to base, said, can we open fire? They got permission, and they blew these two men away because you can't surrender to a helicopter. If people had learned about that first attack 6 months before, when it happened, if WikiLeaks had somehow gotten their hands on it, or any journalistic organization or anyone, a whistleblower, had gotten an image or had the documents of what had taken place, I think that people all over the United States would have called for an investigation. What do you mean? People are surrendering and you blow them away? And perhaps if we had had that information then, and if these men had been investigated at that point, the soldiers in the sky, then what happened 6 months later to this community in New Baghdad and to the Reuters beloved workers and journalists, perhaps that never would have happened because we had the information. This kind of information in a time of war is absolutely critical. It's a matter of life and death. And that's what Julian Assange has been engaged in for all of these years, even the time that he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. I got a chance to meet Julian. Well, apparently I met him first at the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen. I just didn't realize that at the time, outside the Bella Center. We called it the Bella of the Beast. He told me about it a few years later because I went to visit him. Well, first I moderated a forum when he was wearing an ankle monitor, but he was still outside of the Ecuadorian embassy. I moderated a forum in an old boxing ring in London between him and Slavoj Žižek, the philosopher. I went back to interview him when she went into the Ecuadorian embassy. And I went there several times to talk to him. I don't remember everything he said or I said to him, but I realize now, especially this week, though I suspected it at the time, if ever I want an absolute transcript of everything we talked about, I guess I could just apply to the Spanish company that we now know was working for the United States, eavesdropping on everyone. And I'm not just talking about journalists. I'm talking about doctors. I'm talking about lawyers, anyone who is visiting Julian Assange. The fact that he's in Belmarsh prison right now, and Niels Melzer will be broadcasting what he said here in New York, the UN rapporteur, special rapporteur of the United Nations, who actually was skeptical of the whole case at the beginning. And then someone said, you really should look into it. And he realized, he visited Julian in Belmarsh and said, this is a man who is suffering from psychological torture. And it didn't just begin in Belmarsh. He's been in captivity for years. So when we were there in the embassy talking to him about issues of war and peace, I thought about all that Michael Ratner had done in representing him. And here we are in Michael and Karen and Jake's house. And I see that sign on the table that says, Michael Ratner, presente. Michael Ratner was Julian Assange's lawyer. And as Margie said, how many hours he spent here talking to Julian, not to mention going to visit him in the embassy. So I thought I'd end with Michael's words. He writes the epilogue in this book. Michael Ratner, who died a few years ago, who was so dedicated to truth, to honesty, and to justice. Michael said, I've asked myself, why are truth tellers like Assange, Manning, Snowden, and Hammond so important to me? The answer is that they've succeeded in doing what CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I have been trying to do ever since the so-called war on terror began in the wake of the September 11th attacks. For more than a decade, we lawyers at CCR brought at least a dozen lawsuits seeking to expose and end rendition, illegal drone strikes, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the torture at Guantanamo and other U.S. secret prisons. We tried to hold accountable those responsible for war crimes, but each time the government would go into court and say, you can't litigate this national security, every lawsuit was dismissed, even in the open and shut case of Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was taken off a plane at Kennedy Airport, sent to Syria, tortured. We couldn't get past the circuit court, Michael wrote. And he said, I think it would be easier if I had a little flashlight here, which is, I think, very much what Julian Assange represents, light and transparency and illuminating what we should all already know. Michael said, and the one time we did win at the Supreme Court with Russell, it was impossible to enforce the ruling. We'd reached a dead end. Then all of a sudden, people like Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Sarah Harrison, Aaron Swartz, and Jeremy Hammond came out of nowhere. With acts of great courage, they revealed to the world what this country is actually doing. They sparked a much-needed public discussion of the U.S. government's secret, illegal, and inhumane policies, and they brought people into the streets. As a result, we're seeing the unraveling of governments and corporations all over the world. Michael concludes, my experience has taught me that the truth has a way of coming out, even when the most powerful government on earth tries to crush it. Each time a whistleblower, a publisher, or a hacker has been jailed, tortured, or driven to suicide, other truth tellers have come forward, and there will be many more. It's truly a remarkable time we're living in. What we must remember is that we are in this together. It's up to all of us to protect the truth tellers. If we do, we'll have true democracy someday in this country and the world. Michael Ratner, presente, and Julian Assange, if there is justice in the world, well, as the great journalist Alan Nairn used to say, if we lived in a just world, who would be behind bars and who would be free?
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
That's all I can remember.